night were Tribuna Brudu, Dirt Tribune, and Garage Leeds, Garage in Leeds. Tribuna Brudu rhymes with Tribuna Ludu, People's Tribune, the Communist Party newspaper. Garage Leeds is a cold wave band, cold wave being, according to Zagos, the latest English style, like new wave but gloomier. Both bands were rotten. Some of the punks began slam dancing, or trying to. They were so drunk they kept missing each other. An enormous punk with a knife in his belt and a neck like a thigh began eyeing Sophia, Mark, Tom, and me. "One good thing about a socialist system," I said to Sophia, "is the low crime rate."
"There are neighborhoods in Warsaw that I will not even go to," said Sophia.
"At night?"
"In the daytime."
"Is this one of them?"
"Now it is."
A large fight broke out as we left. Remont is as hip as it gets in Poland. "Well, that's enough of that," I said. "Let's do something normal. Let's see what ordinary people do in the evening. You know, just by way of contrast." Sophia looked dubious. Tom shrugged. But Mark was all for it. He had one of those over-earnest guidebooks to Europe's nooks and crannies. "There's a wild boar restaurant," he said, flipping through the guide's back pages. "It's supposed to have local color." Sophia looked very dubious. We found the restaurant at the corner of two dark streets. It was called Dzik, which means wild boar. A political argument was raging as we came in. Two elderly and very inebriated men were shouting nose to nose. First old souse.
"Reagan's our man."
Second old souse.
"He's a prick."
First old souse.
"Reagan and Gorbachev, they're both pricks."
Second old souse.
"Not Reagan, Reagan's our man."
Sophia translated and said, being serious, I think,
"There is a wide range of political opinion in Poland. Fundamentally, it is pro-American."
"The only pro-American country in Europe," said Tom, "except for maybe Czechoslovakia and Hungary." We sat down and ordered vodka. An ancient bag lady clumped in and began screaming at a woman at the table next to ours. I asked Sophia to translate this also.
"It is very vivid language," she said.
"Remarkable colloquialisms," said Tom, and he pulled out a notebook and began to scribble. The waitresses leaned against the walls, listening intently to the tirade. The cook came out of the kitchen and listened, too.
"The nicest thing she said so far is that the woman at the table is a whore," said Sophia.
The bag lady stumbled out and stumbled back and started over again. This somehow set off a fight between two men who didn't seem to have anything to do with either of the women. They cuffed and wrestled their way across the room until the head waiter reluctantly pried them apart. But one of the men was too drunk to stand up without the support of the fellow who had been slugging him. He fell onto our table, which flipped into the air, catapulting Vodka and Mark, who had been leaning his elbows on the dirty placemat, across the room. Nobody made a move to clean up. We changed seats. A large and extraordinarily unwashed young man came up and jabbered at us.
"He says his name is Zygmunt," said Tom, "and he wants to shake our hands because we are Americans."
We each shook the fellow's filthy mitt. 3 minutes later, he came back and said his name was Zygmunt, and he wanted to shake our hands. This continued through dinner. When we left, the fight victim was snoring on the sidewalk. "I usually try to pull them into a doorway," said Tom, "so the police won't get them. But this one was too befouled to touch." The wild boar, by the way, wasn't bad. Pig meat in any form is pretty good in Poland. Everything else, except the beer and vodka, is horrid. You could use the beef for tennis balls, the bread for hockey pucks, and the mashed potatoes to make library paste. If you swallow any of the gravy, do not induce vomiting. Call a physician immediately. I had mentioned to Tom that we should probably avoid fresh leafy vegetables because of the recent Chernobyl contamination. He almost choked laughing. "If you see a fresh leafy vegetable, let someone know," he said. "They'll want to announce it on television as a triumph of state planning." The subject on which I was supposed to be reporting was not, as you may have guessed, very interesting. The only thing that seemed to set Polish rock apart from the rest of Europe's colorless pop music was a certain dark and somber tone. I talked to an American exchange student who'd been kicked out of Dupa, Ass, a Krakow cold wave band, because his guitar playing wasn't gloomy enough. But the meetings that Interpress set up with musicians, producers, studio engineers, etc., were interesting. Morbid and horrible, but interesting. It's amazing what obstacles are thrown in the way of workaday existence when the government is bigger than the country it governs and bureaucracy encompasses all animate and most inanimate objects. I talked to music makers, but if they'd been brain surgeons, architects, or biochemists, only the details of frustration would have been different. Every song, whether it's to be recorded or performed in concert or even sung in the smallest club, must be submitted to the censor board.
Poland is the only country in the Eastern Bloc that admits to having censorship, a Polish record producer told me, with something akin to pride.
The censors look for political meaning and sexual innuendo. They may veto a whole song or bowdlerize it line by line. As a result, lyrics tend to be Dylan-esque, but unlike old Minnesota Mudthroat, Poles have good reason to be cryptic. Zbigniew Holdus, leader of Perfect, which I was told was the best Polish band of the 80s, went too far with his song, There Is No God. There is a tear on the altar, a little bit smaller than a drop of blood. There is nothing else on the altar, not even a drop of blood. Any content is suspect. The commies objected, even though they're supposed to be atheists. In Poland, a Fender guitar costs between 150,000 and 200,000 zlotys. There are only about 5 officially sanctioned places to play in the whole country. I visited one of the best sound studios. It had 16 tracks. To do a proper final mix, the tape has to be taken to West Germany. It's impossible to say how many records the most popular groups could sell. There's a shortage of record plastic. But the Poles plug along, keeping up with the trends. The music videos I saw were no worse than MTV's, though many had been shot on 8mm home movie film. The synthesizer tunes I heard were done on the kind of electric keyboards we used to have at roller rinks, but the results weren't any dippier than the new Prince album. All this jury-rigging was admirable, but it was like watching genius high school sophomores tinkering in the rec room with Dad's dictaphone. And the people I talked to were no happier than genius high school sophomores usually are. I had some drinks with an extraordinary rock critic I'll call Kazimierz. Indeed, I had a great many drinks with him. We sat down with a bottle of vodka at 3 in the afternoon and drank, Polish style, 2-ounce shots taken at a gulp until the bottle was gone. Then somebody stopped by his house with another bottle, and we drank that. Kazimierz is a vademecum of popular music, from Johnny Ace to Joy Division. He's a well-known editor and commentator in Poland, and a popular disc jockey and journalist. He speaks English, German, and Russian, and he lives with his mother in a housing development. The housing development was a high-rise, but with freight elevator-style electric lift and steel stairs and doors. The apartment had 3 tiny rooms. The walls were concrete, of course. It was a sort of basement in the sky. And here was Kazimierz, an educated, hard-working man of 40, with only an 8-by-10-foot bedroom to call his own. We didn't talk about music for long.
I was working overseas when martial law came, said Kazimierz. I was terrified of what might be happening here. It took me 6 months to get back in the country, and all that time I could get no news about anyone I knew. When I landed at the airport, I saw the ZOMO, the new riot police that had just been constituted, and they were standing at the airport eating ice cream cones. At that moment, I knew they were human. I knew there was hope.
And that was all the hope he had to cling to, just that the enemy was human. This country has not had a hopeful history, I said.
I'll tell you a Polish joke you may understand now, said Kazimierz. It explains something about our national survival. One Pole is telling another about his visit to America. He says, I went to see a fellow and he fixed us drinks.
Yes, says the second Pole.
Then do you know what he did? Says the first.
No, says the second.
He put the cap back on the bottle.
I asked Kazimierz what had happened to Solidarity. I haven't heard anyone mention Lech Wałęsa, I said,
except one American reporter.
No one cares about that anymore. It's old history, said Casimir's. Only people from the West think it means anything anymore.
We drank ourselves blind. In the next room, Casimir's mother sat between narrow slab walls, stolidly watching government TV. My notes are a jumble. I can make almost nothing of them, except at the bottom of one page, in wobbly, painstaking letters I've written, "We have no weapons and no chances. No weapons and no church. We live in a land that's not ours." On the day before I left, I took a long walk with Sophia.
"I'd like to see the West," she said.
"Can you leave?"
"If you are of a certain level, it can be arranged, but you need an invitation, a job or a sponsor of some kind. Do you think I could find a job in the West?"
"Sophia, you're fluent in what, Polish, English, German, Spanish, and Arabic?"
"Yes, but I'm only fair in Russian and Latin."
"And you have how many higher degrees?"
"Nearly three now."
"Sophia, you'd have to carry a pistol to keep from being made president of the World Bank. Would you defect?"
"No. It would break my parents' hearts. My father fought in the resistance. He is not a communist, but he belongs to the Peasants' Party that is allied with the government."
Sophia shrugged.
"Besides, this is my country. I should see it through."
We were walking down Nowy Świat Street in front of the offices of the Central Committee of the Polish United Workers' Party, which is what the communists call themselves in Poland. Sophia said,
"This will sound strange to you, but when the army took over and martial law was first declared, there was hope somehow. The army has always had prestige, for their bravery against the Germans in 1939 and the Russians in the 1920s and so on. All the reserves were called up, all the young men. When we saw the soldiers at the barricades, they were friends of ours from school, not like the police who come from a different class. General Jaruzelski raised the Polish national flag for the first time next to the party flag on the Central Committee building."
Sophia paused. "And?" I said.
"And that was all."
Sophia gestured to the street, to the lumpy, gray-faced people.
"Everything is the same as it was."
Then she brightened.
"Have you heard about the Russian and American generals? They are arguing about who has the best troops. The Russian general says, 'We feed our troops 1,000 calories a day.' The American general says, 'We feed our troops 3,000 calories a day.' 'Nonsense,' says the Russian general. 'No one can eat an entire sack of potatoes in 24 hours.
On the way back to my hotel, I finally got arrested. Four large policemen blew their whistles and surrounded me on the plaza in front of the Palace of Culture and Science. They hustled me into a police van. One paged through my passport, while the other three glowered menacingly. I met their stares with a steady gaze. They weren't going to break me. I sat in the sweltering van with my legs crossed casually, a faint smile on my lips. I was determined to let no emotion show. I fancied they'd rarely dealt with as cool a customer as I. And I'd composed the lead sentence and first two paragraphs of the New York Times story about my arrest on trumped-up espionage charges before they got it across that I'd been nabbed for jaywalking. I was fined $2. So I didn't become a prisoner of conscience or see any salt mines or brainwashing in Poland. That would have been too exciting. And I didn't see any evil empire. That would have been too interesting. Communism doesn't really starve or execute that many people. Mostly, it just bores them to death. Life behind the Iron Curtain is like living with your parents forever, literally in many cases. There are a million do's and don'ts. It's a hassle getting the car keys. No, life behind the Iron Curtain is worse than that. It's Boy Scout camp. Dusty, dilapidated, crummy food, lousy accommodations, and asshole counselors with whistles.
"Tweet! Count off by threes! Tweet, tweet! Who short-sheeted the Politburo? Tweet, tweet, tweet! A good Pole is loyal, helpful, obedient!"
It's reveille and the buddy system and liver and Kool-Aid and capture the flag for all eternity. And Mom and Dad will never come to get you.
They're snoring in the next bunk. Is it worth risking nuclear war and the annihilation of mankind to avoid living like this? Don't ask anybody who just got back from Warsaw. Weekend Getaway, Heritage USA. January 1987. My friend Dorothy and I spent a weekend at Heritage USA, the born-again Christian resort and amusement park created by television evangelists Jim and Tammy Baker, who have been so much in the news. Dorothy and I came to scoff, but went away converted. Unfortunately, we were converted to Satanism. Now we're up half the night, going to witches' Sabbaths, and have to spend our free time reciting the Lord's Prayer backward and scouring the neighborhood for black dogs to sacrifice. Frankly, it's a nuisance, but if it keeps us from going to the Heritage USA part of heaven, it will be worth it. Just kidding. In fact, we didn't actually come to Heritage USA to scoff. At least I didn't. I came because I was angry. Normally, I take a live-and-let-live attitude toward refried Jesus-wheezing TV preachers. They've got their role in life, and I've got mine. Their role is to be sanctimonious panhandlers. My role is to have a good time. They don't pray for cocaine and orgies. I don't go on the tube and ask people to send me $100. But when a place like Heritage USA starts advertising fun in the sun, and Heritage's founders start having drug blasts and zany extramarital frolics, I feel they're stepping on my turf. Heritage USA is a fair-sized chunk of Christendom, 2,300 acres. It's half an hour from the go-go New South Sunbelt town of Charlotte, North Carolina, just over the border into the pokey Old South Bible Belt county of York, South Carolina. The Heritage entrance gate appears to be a colonial Williamsburg Turnpike toll plaza. Admission is free, however. Inside the gate, you have the same vaguely depressing pine barrens that you have outside. A dozen roads meander through the scrub with a sly purposelessness of burglary lookouts. Not that Heritage USA is an empty vessel, Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 34. By no means. Recreation facilities are ministered unto you abundantly, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 11. There are playgrounds, kiddie rides, bridle paths, tennis courts, and swimming pools, where I guess you have to lose faith at least temporarily, or you'll just stand around on top of the water. And there are vacation cottages for rent and condo homes for sale, plus campgrounds and acres of gravel to park your Winnebago on. You can see the house where Billy Graham grew up and make Amityville Horror jokes about it. A golf course is being laid out. I'll rush back as soon as it's done to hear what new kinds of blasphemy Christian golf leads to. The rough ways shall be made smooth. Luke, chapter 3, verse 5. Thou shalt not lift up any iron. Deuteronomy, chapter 7, verse 5. This cup is the New Testament in my blood. 1 Corinthians, chapter 11, verse 25. I will put my hook in thy nose. 2 Kings, chapter 19, verse 28. And you can visit the world headquarters of PTL, which is in the middle of a huge scandal right now, just like a real television network. Amidst these lesser marvels is an artificial lake with a 52-foot water slide and the world's largest wave-making pool. A little choo-choo train goes all the way around the lakeshore, and across from the train station is an enormous hotel, shopping mall, theater, restaurant, and indoor inspirational loitering center. The architects must have been touched by the Holy Spirit, because they were definitely speaking the language of design in tongues when they did this. At one end, there's the Heritage Grand Hotel. Georgian on steroids, Monticello mated with a Ramada Inn and finished in Wendy's old-fashioned hamburgers Gothic. This is attached to a 200-yard stretch of bogus Victorian house fronts, which screen the shopping mall. The house fronts have extruded plastic gingerbread details and are painted in colors unfit for baboon posteriors. Interesting that the same God who inspired the cathedral at Chartres, Westminster Abbey, and the Sistine Chapel also inspired this. That big guy upstairs can be a real kidder. The Christmas decorations were still up at Heritage. From the entrance gate all the way to the water slide, the place was festooned with Yule lights and other pagan symbols of the season, tinseled evergreens, holly wreaths, snowmen, candy canes, but no Santa Claus.
His elves were there, stuffing stockings and wrapping presents, but Santa himself was nowhere to be found. When we walked into the hotel lobby, carolers were singing, "You'd better not frown, you'd better not cry, you'd better not pout, I'm telling you why, Jesus Christ is coming real soon." And I thought Heritage USA was going to be dumb. But I'd only been there 15 minutes, and I was already confronted by enough serious theological questions to send St. Thomas Aquinas back to Bible college. Did Santa die on the cross? Will he be resurrected at Macy's? Were Christ's disciples really elves? When the second coming happens, will Jesus bring toy trains? While I puzzled over these mysteries, Dorothy went shopping. She's normally as good at this as any human female, but she was back in minutes with no bags or packages and a dazed, perplexed expression, like a starved Ethiopian given a piece of wax fruit. What could be the matter? We went into the bookstore, and I found out. There on the shelves were personal affirmations of faith by Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, a born-again diet plan, a transcription of the horrible, though rather unimaginative, things you can hear if you play rock and roll records backward, and a weighty tome arguing that every time the New Testament says wine, it really means grape juice. But I couldn't find anything you'd actually call a book. The Bibles themselves had names like A Bible Even You Can Read and The Bible in English, Just Like Jesus Talked. Then we went into the music store. It was the same thing. There were racks of tapes and records by Christian pop groups, Christian folk groups, Christian heavy metal groups, Christian reggae groups, all of them singing original compositions about the Lord. No album was actually titled I Found God and Lost My Talent, but I'm sure that was just an oversight. There was even a Christian rap music cassette called Bible Break. The Bible is the holy book, so let's open it up and take a look. You got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and so on to Revelations, with complete lack of rhythm or meter. I was witnessing a miracle, I was sure, or auditing one anyway. Here was something that sounded worse than genuine rap. The toy store was weirder yet. The stuffed toys had names like Born Again Bunny and Devotion Duck. A child-sized panoply of biblical weapons was for sale, including a shield of righteousness, a helmet of faith, and a sword of truth that looked ideal for a clobber of little sister. And there were biblical action figures, a Goliath with a bashed skull, David looking fruity in a goatskin sarong, Samson and Delilah as Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver. Come seductively dressed, read the sell copy on Delilah's bubble pack. Here was a shopper's hell indeed. I looked at the people crowding the Heritage Main Street Mall. They didn't seem to be having much fun. Many of them were old, none looked very well off. There was a dullness in their movements and expressions. Even the little kids looked somber and thick. In the men's room stall where I went to sneak a cigarette, there were only four bits of graffiti. Do you know where your wife is at? Jesus is number one. 666. Please don't mark these walls. The last, scratched into the paint with a key or pocket knife. I almost don't have the heart to make fun of these folks. It's like hunting dairy cows with a high-powered rifle and scope. Then again, I have to consider what they'd do to me if they caught me having my idea of a vacation. Undressed bimbo in a sleazy Florida hotel room, bottle of Vaseline intensive care lotion, some drugged wine. In fact, you already know what they did when they caught Jim Baker. Heck, they want to hang the likes of Jim and me, and all I want to do is rib them a little. I've always figured that if God wanted us to go to church a lot, he'd have given us bigger behinds to sit on and smaller heads to think with. But God or carbohydrates or something had done that for these people. They all had huge bottoms, immense bottoms. It looked like everyone in the place had stuffed a chair cushion down the back of his leisure slacks. And what leisure slacks? Heal them, O Lord, for they are injured in the taste buds. Dorothy and I had dressed quietly for the occasion, but my button-down shirt and chinos and her blue blazer and tartan skirt made us stick out like nude calypso dancers. We were wearing the only natural fibers for 2,300 acres in any direction. "You know what you've got here?" I said to Dorothy. "This is white trash behaving itself. The only thing in the world worse than white trash not behaving itself." "Shh," said Dorothy. "That's mean." These people aren't having any fun, I said. They should join the clan. They'd be better off. They could hoot and holler and whatnot. The clan doesn't do all that much really bad stuff anymore because there are too many FBI double agents in it. And if these folks joined the clan, they could smoke and drink again. Plus, they'd get to wear something halfway decent, like an all-cotton bedsheet.
PJ, said Dorothy, stop it. Everybody can hear you.
I'm serious, I said. All you people, you really ought to... Dorothy slapped a hand over my mouth and pulled me outside. The next day, Dorothy and I pretended to be married and went house hunting in the Christian condominium subdevelopment. The homes were mostly freestanding ranch jobs built on slab foundations and supplied with a couple $100 of old-timey exterior trim. Each unit is supposedly built to order, but neither the designs nor the floor plans can be altered. What God and contractor have joined together, let no man put asunder. Condo prices range from $128,000 to $144,000. I checked the real estate sections in the local papers, and this seemed to be almost a third again the going rate. The model homes showed no special religious features, no Last Supper-style dining areas, walk-on-the-water beds, or total immersion adult baptismal pools in the Johns. There was also a sad lack of evangelical hard sell. Dorothy and I had hoped for a real estate salesperson who spoke in tongues, not that real estate persons don't usually. Instead, there was a lonely-looking middle-aged lady with a layer of Tammy Baker-style makeup.
Now, I live by myself here, she said, but gosh, there are so many things going on, I never have a moment to feel lonely.
She was interrupted by a phone call from Maine.
Excuse me, she said. This lady is calling from all the way up in Maine.
The caller was, I gathered, very elderly.
Yes,
said the real estate lady on the phone.
You can live right here at Heritage USA. No, Jim and Tammy don't actually live at the Heritage Center, but they live real close by. No, dear, you shouldn't buy something you haven't even seen. Well, maybe you can get your minister to drive you down.
We slipped out during the phone call, feeling a little creepy. Something is drawing forlorn old ladies and poor, morose families to Heritage USA. 5 million of them came in 1985. It can't be Jesus doing a thing like that. He's a compassionate guy, isn't he? We took one more walk through the Heritage Mall. I was eavesdropping hard, hoping for some final telling quote. No luck. Everybody was on good behavior, just like the day before. There were no screaming toddlers, no running kids, no griping adults. It was like being in the First Church of Christ hanging out at the mall. Dorothy heard a jewelry salesman tell his customer, "It has a lifetime guarantee, or until Jesus returns, whichever." A goody-two-shoes treacle seemed to flow sluggishly through the place, and I think it was making Dorothy a little crazy. She kept tugging on my coat sleeve and whispering that we should go behind a Coke machine or in a mop closet or someplace and pet. They must have this problem a lot at Heritage USA, because all the Coke machines were right out in the middle of the rooms, and the mop closets were locked. We tried a stairwell, but it had a floor-to-ceiling window opening to the hotel lobby. And that was when it dawned on me. There's only one explanation for Heritage USA. Jim and Tammy were working for the other side. Their own recent behavior seems to make that obvious. And consider the other evidence. A bookstore without books. A record shop without music. What else could these be but the vain and empty works of the devil? And Heritage USA has lots of rules and ugly architecture, just like Communist Russia, that den of Satan. And don't forget that fundamentalism prohibits premarital sex, yet you can't have a proper black mass without using a naked virgin as an altar. Put two and two together. It's not a pretty picture. Furthermore, as a result of our visit to Heritage USA, Dorothy and I had committed every one of the 7 deadly sins. Pride. Looking at our fellow visitors had turned us into awful snobs. Wrath. We wanted to murder the architects. Lust. If we could have found an open mop closet. Avarice. By proxy, Jim and Tammy Baker, as founders of Heritage USA, had committed this sin for us. Envy. How come Jim and Tammy get to live so high on the hog? Why didn't we think of Heritage USA? Gluttony. For a quick drink. Sloth.
We spent 3 days in bed recovering from the drunk we went on after we got out of there. This is no way to have fun. Everybody likes a good laugh, and there's nothing wrong with that. But on this year's vacation, steer clear of Heritage USA. For the sake of your immortal soul, stay home and take drugs and have sex, the way Jim and Tammy do. After all, I understand they've been forgiven. The post-Marcos Philippines, life in the archipelago after 1 year of justice, democracy, and things like that. March 1987. Well, everything's fine in the Philippines now. Smelly old Marcos has been given the gate, and earnest, Catholic, good-to-the-bone Cory Aquino is president. Everyone in the country has a fulfilling career. All those cardboard houses down in the Manila slums are being gentrified. Track lighting, redwood decks, nickel-plated Victorian plumbing fixtures from Renovator Supply. The citizens of the Philippines are rich and happy. They won't go communist or get another corrupt and egomaniacal dictator for at least a week. I was 9 years old when I fell in love with the Philippines. My father had been there during World War II, practically the only place he'd ever been outside Ohio. He was a salesman who had wanted to be an engineer. He'd taken some night courses, but what with the Depression and a family to support, it never happened. Yet for one moment, he was an engineer, a chief petty officer in the Navy Construction Battalions, the CBs, building docks, warehouses, and barracks in the Philippines. When my father died in 1956, I found his photo albums from the war. To a more sophisticated kid, the Philippines might not have seemed like much. Famous for what? Houseboys and ugly mahogany water buffalo carvings? But to me, in Toledo, Ohio, the Philippines represented everything I could hope for in the way of romance. The albums were filled with pictures of burned-out Jap tanks, bomb craters, and sunk LSTs, and also of lustrous beaches, mangrove-edged lagoons, and ancient Spanish mission churches. There were pictures of my dad, not the pale, workaday dad I'd known, but a thin, tanned guy in faded khakis with 1 foot on the bumper of a Jeep and a Lucky jammed in the corner of his mouth. That dad had a smile I don't think you can get in Ohio. And at the back of one of the albums, folded behind a flap of paper, were pictures of Philippine women. Dark, smooth, small, beautiful women who seemed to have misplaced their bathing suits. It was 30 years before I got to the Philippines, but the islands were no disappointment. I arrived in February 1986, in the midst of the Marcos ouster. I found adventure and excitement. In fact, I saw more action than my father had. His battalion went through the whole war with only one casualty. A palm tree fell on somebody. The country was as exotic, and the people were as attractive, as I'd known they would be. I met a young woman I liked very much, a Filipino journalist named Tina Luz, with anthracite hair and the most beautiful color skin I've ever seen, something between peanut butter and bronze. And the society, culture, and politics of the Philippines were unfathomable, desperate, violent, and strange, which is a large part of what romance is all about. I was there for a month and spent the next year trying to wrangle a way back. I invented dozens of journalistic hooks for Philippine articles. I told my editors at Rolling Stone that each bungled coup attempt was the hottest story since Morton Thiokol used the Challenger to move teacher hazing into the space age. "The Philippines are democracy with its thumb in the door hinge of history," I'd bluster. "Civilization as we know it is walking the balance beam in the political gymnastics of death." And other such. Finally, on the first anniversary of the Cory takeover, they gave in. I returned to Manila to find myself a hero, sort of. Each of the 1,000-plus members of the foreign press who had been present at the Marcos heave-ho was made a hero of the revolution. There was an austerely dignified award ceremony. By that, I mean we had to buy our own drinks, in clear violation of the International Journalist's Code of Truth, Fairness, and an open bar. But Cory Aquino came to thank us in person for having suddenly discovered, in 1986, that Marcos was a pig. "Joe Rock from Rolling Magazine," said the master of ceremonies. I mounted the podium, and General Ramos, the Philippine Army Chief of Staff, put the medal around my neck as canned applause played on the PA system. It's a silly-looking medal, showing a hand making the pro-Corey Laban coalition L sign with a little happy face on the tip of the upraised index finger. But it's the only medal I'm ever going to get. And hell, I'm proud. Freedom Week, as the anniversary of the Corey Revolution was called, was choked with self-congratulatory festivities, songwriting contests, public speaking competitions, a display of children's art about people power, fireworks, street dances, and 11 million Catholic masses. Dignitaries and various fans of social justice arrived from all over the world. Even Peter, Paul, and Mary came to play. The Filipinos were pretty sure they were famous. Everybody recognized Puff the Magic Dragon, anyway, and sang along.
"We were in El Salvador in 1983 and in Nicaragua last year," a fervent Mary Travers said to the puzzled crowd, who didn't see what that had to do with anything.
The Corey government was supposed to get rid of communists. On the last day of Freedom Week, 1.5 million people shoved themselves into the avenue along the front of Camp Carney. Camp Carney is the military base where Defense Minister Enrile and Chief of Staff Ramos had announced the revolt that brought Corey to power. Marco sent loyalist troops to snuff the coup, and unarmed civilians, though rather less than 1.5 million of them, blocked tanks and armored personnel carriers with their bodies. Camp Carney's gates were opened for the anniversary. Some of the troops inside had already been involved in another revolt against Corey. And 6 months later, nearly half of them would rise up in more stupid mutiny. But today, they were all smiles. You could tell it was a special occasion because the soldiers had their shoes on. 1,000 vendors sold mementos of the revolution, all of them yellow, Corey's campaign color, and most of them bearing Mrs. Aquino's likeness. One t-shirt said simply, "I am a Filipino." But what passes for a size XL in the Philippines splits right down the beer gut when I put it on. There were lots of speeches. It was hard to tell who was making them or where, but loudspeakers had been nailed to all the phone poles so everyone could hear. Filipinos enjoy a good political diatribe, but in the hopelessly decent Corey administration, rhetorical bombast is always trimmed with polite qualifications.
"Professionals, students, rich and poor, embraced themselves and fought," bellowed the kickoff speaker, "almost nonviolently against what we thought might be an autocratic government."
The autocrats themselves were by no means gnashing their cosmetic orthodontia. The parking lot at the Manila Polo Club was as full of Range Rovers and BMWs as it had been in Marcos' days. The club was holding a Freedom Cup match to celebrate the revolution and decide the Philippine Polo Championship. A priest blessed the ponies with a squirt bottle full of holy water and then prayed at length for Corey and her government. The Hermes-scarfed and Ralph Lauren-shirted crowd, people at polo matches actually do wear polo brand clothes, at least in the Philippines, prayed along and applauded vigorously. Meanwhile, Manila was the same squalid mess it's always been. Corey Aquino is the most upright, kindly, and honorable person running a country today. Given the other people running countries, that's probably safe to say. And there doesn't seem to be anything particularly wrong with the men and women she's got helping her, especially compared with the pack of muck spouts, scissors bills, jacklegs, and goons who used to be in charge. But it would be nice if cashews on the top always meant ice cream on the bottom. It would be nice if swell national leaders meant instant peace and plenty. There are more than 57 million Filipinos spread across 7,107 islands. Almost every island has a communist or Muslim insurrection of some kind. Per capita income is $652 a year. It seems hard to find an army officer who isn't ready to toss a coup d'etat. And pages could be filled just listing the country's other problems. It would be amazing if the Corey government even knew where to start. One of the features of Freedom Week was an inventors' convention. It was a modest affair. Most of the inventions had to do with improved charcoal braziers for home heat and better ways to spread water buffalo dung. But there was one very complicated mechanical device with a hand-lettered sign taped on the front. Mach 7 Super Machine. Compact and portable. 90% local materials, durable, all metal parts, very simple and practical, will create job opportunities for the out-of-school youth. Here was a paradigm of the Aquino administration,
Nowhere on that sign did it say what the Mach 7 super machine was supposed to do. I asked Franco, the driver I'd hired for the duration of my stay, if things were better since Corey took over.
Oh, yes, he said. There are lots of firecrackers. This was forbidden before.
Some things had changed in Manila. There was a new statue of Corey's husband, the martyred Ninoy Aquino, in the Makati business district. Ninoy is portrayed on the steps of an airline ramp at the moment the assassin's bullets hit him. The original bronze casting had a clear plastic rod with a dove of peace mounted on top, emerging from Ninoy's left clavicle. This made the hero of the anti-Marcos opposition look like he was getting crapped on by a pigeon. So the rod was removed, and the bird attached directly to the shoulder for a Long John Silver effect. Ninoy now looks like a drunk pirate in a business suit falling down the cellar stairs. The police were easier to bully, at least if you were a hero of the revolution. Franco had nipped a big ABC Press placard from the Manila Hotel and stuck it in the front window of his car. This was enough to get us waved through most of the nighttime roadblocks set up around Manila, supposedly to keep communist infiltrators from coming to town. But one evening, I was on the way back from a party with Tina and Black Star photographer John Giannini. Some grubby-looking, overarmed cops motioned us over for a search.
They think I'm a prostitute, said Tina. See, the sergeant is unscrewing his flashlight already. That's where he hides his payoffs.
Rank him out in Tagalog, said Giannini.
Believe me, said Tina. It would be much better if I speak English.
Giannini, who was a big guy, got out of the car. Just what's the problem here?
Well, said the policeman, we are holding these roadblocks of narcotics, illegal guns, robberies, and guerrillas.
We don't have any, said John.
Well, said the policeman, when we were seeing two foreign journalists with a Filipina.
Three foreign journalists, said John. Miss Luz here works for the Washington Post. Washington Post. Big nervous smiles from all the police. They knew what had happened to the last strong-arm type who ran afoul of the Yankee news hogs. He's ass-canned and stuck off in exile with his fat, crazy wife and her shoe collection.
Please be our guest to go, said the sergeant.
Other things, I didn't have the heart to go see whether they'd changed or not. There's a ski slope-sized pile of rotting, burning trash on the north side of town called Smoky Mountain. 1,000 people, many of them sick and dying, live in the filth. I never want to go back there. There are some kinds of desolation that leave you impotent in the fucking that's life. I could turn my pockets out for the Smoky Mountain residents, but that wouldn't go far. I could throw up, but I don't see how that would help. I could pester the dump pickers as I had in 86 and write it up in a colorful way and make a buck off the thing, which is what I guess I'm doing anyway. I asked Giannini, who'd just been to shoot the place for Black Star, if Smoky Mountain had changed since Marcos.
It's bigger, he said.
But are the people any better off?
Yeah, they've got more garbage.
Of course, I was happy in Manila. I had Franco standing by with the car. I had a big room at the Manila Hotel, General MacArthur's wartime HQ. No doubt, if I hung around long enough, somebody'd take another whack at insurrection, and I could write about that. Meanwhile, I spent my afternoons by the hotel pool and lolled through sunset cocktails at Tina's house, chaperoned by the maid her father had sent up from the family sugar plantation on Negros Island. Some of the local journalists chartered a boat, and we went sailing on Manila Bay. We drank at the servicemen's bars on Mabini Street and joked with the lackadaisical, semi-naked go-go dancers. We went to parties and dances. There is suffering on Earth, I know, and plenty of that suffering is in the Philippines. But if I can't subtract from the world's sum of misery, do I have to add to it personally? It's one of these questions I mean to take up if I ever get religion. Unfortunately, the phone messages and telexes from Rolling Stone were beginning to pile up. What are you doing over there? What the hell are you doing over there? What is this story supposed to be about? Etc. I had to earn my keep. I had to go explain why the Philippines hadn't immediately turned into Japan or Singapore when Corey took over. And I had to find some nastiness to illustrate the problem. No bodies, no bylines, as journalists say.
Up in the hills, the communist NPA, the New People's Army, was plugging along with its decade-old civil war. That might be a good excuse to stay for another couple of weeks. However, the NPA were press shy at the moment. They'd had a ceasefire with the Cory government and some peace talks, but when the communists found out Cory wasn't going to give them a hug and hand them the country, they coped to mope. My fellow reporters were lined up all over Manila waiting on NPA contacts so they could slog through the hills and get an earful of bullshit gripes. Some had been waiting for more than a month. I complained to Franco. If I just keep going to polo games, I said, and working on my tan and taking Tina out to dinner, sooner or later my editors are going to catch on and I'll be covering the Bon Jovi Iowa tour. I've got to find some trouble to get into.
You want to talk to NPA? Said Franco. My Uncle Carlos is NPA, the brother of my wife's mother. I will take you there tomorrow already, to Marlita, in Pampanga province.
But Franco, I said, you're a real Corista.
Oh, yes.
Don't you argue with your uncle? Franco looked confounded.
We go a couple times in the year to see my family of my wife, he said,
as if that explained any possible political contradiction. This wasn't exactly like the American Civil War, where brother fought brother and all that. So I got up at dawn the next day. The front page story was headlined, Cop Chief Slain in Ambush. The police chief of San Luis Pampanga, read the lead, was killed in an ambush shortly before noon yesterday by jeepney-riding communist rebels. San Luis was the town next to Marlita. About 30 kilometers from Marlita, Franco and I stopped for a cup of coffee. A teenage kid gave me a careful look and then jumped on a motor tricycle and sped up the road. Franco nudged me.
You see, they know you already.
I'm not sure what I was expecting in the uncle, an addled old veteran of the 50s communist HUK rebellion, I guess. Certainly not the fat and amiable politician who greeted us at the door of a cement six-room house, the only sizable home in the village. Franco's Uncle Carlos had been a barrio captain in Marlita for 16 years. There was a pickup truck in the carport and an immense color television in the living room, draped in a sort of chintz slipcover with tassel-fringed curtains pulled back to reveal the screen. Professional wrestling played the whole time we were there. Full liquor bottles were displayed around the room, along with the kind of large china dogs won at carnival booths.
"People here like the NPA," said Carlos. "If things are stolen, the NPA will help. Once you need the help, if you are right, the NPA will help you. But if you are wrong..."
Carlos made a grave face. I'm willing to bet he's recently seen The Godfather on that color TV.
"They may be the ones to kill you."
"I understand there was a little trouble over in San Luis," I ventured. I didn't know if the police chief bump off was a touchy subject or what.
"Ha!" said Carlos. "The police chief shot for corruption! The third police chief in Pampanga this year!"
Apparently it wasn't a touchy subject.
"He was charging 10 pesos to each person for each load of vegetables to go to Manila. People complained to the NPA."
Then Carlos started in on the mayor of Marlita.
"The mayor here. If his son has a birthday, he will tell the barrio captain, 'You give me one big pig, one sack of rice.' The barrio captain has to collect it," said Carlos, pointing at himself. "The NPA is always helping people," he added ominously.
"So, Mr. Mayor, if you happen to read this, I recommend you look for other work." "How many NPA are around here anyway?" I said.
"One or two only by day," said Carlos and winked. "Group by group at night."
As we talked, a number of young men were strolling too casually in and out of the barrio captain's house. I gathered the NPA guerrillas were trying to make up their minds whether to schmooze, shoot me, or skedaddle. Mrs. Carlos kept stuffing us with food, sugar rolls, heaps of steaming rice, fresh eggs, and beef stew from a can, canned foods, like the full liquor bottles are rural status symbols, and jugs of iced water, iced tea, and Pepsi Cola, all this at 10 in the morning. Just before I burst, word came the NPA would chat. Carlos, Franco, and I drove along a levee through the rice paddies to another barrio 2 kilometers away. It was a group of 40 little houses on a rise. Small children, the watchdogs of Philippine villages, could see everything that approached.
Dozens of paths spread from the barrio toward Mount Arayat, where the guerrillas hide. Dozens of vapor trails spread in the sky, too, from F-16s. The NPA's Mount Arayat base and the USA's Clark Air Force Base are 20 kilometers apart. Although the Pampanga River runs through Marlita, the rice paddies were parched and fallow. Carlos said it had been a dry winter, too dry for a second rice crop. "What about irrigation?" I asked. He shrugged. "The irrigation pump is broken." We drove by it, a little gasoline job the size of a rider mower engine. They were killing each other over nickel and dime corruption in these villages, while the wealth of the entire community could be doubled with one high school shop class water pump fix-it project. Understand that, and you can understand the whole third world. And please, phone or write if you do. Once we were inside the second barrio, a dozen kids showed us where to park. We got out of the car, and an old man motioned for us to follow him. He took us to a little house on stilts, weathered black and half hidden by a bamboo grove. But the old man wouldn't just let us inside. First, he had to lead us through a vegetable patch beside the house, and over a fence into a chicken pen in the backyard, out through a hole in the chicken wire, into a pigsty on the other side of the house, over another fence, and back to the front door. I guess this was supposed to confuse us as to our exact whereabouts. The house had no windows. The light came through the bamboo slat walls and floor, as though we were in a world made entirely of levelor blinds. Seven NPA fighters were sprawled in two tiny rooms. They were finishing a meager lunch. Breadcrumbs and a couple of dried fishtails were left on two communal plates. Three guns were visible, one Armalite, which is what the Filipinos call the M16, and two Korean War vintage Chinese Communist infantry rifles. Half a dozen 223 caliber Armalite bullets were arranged neatly on a table in a corner. The NPA leader was called Commander Melody, not an unusual moniker by Philippine standards. There are Manila tycoons of 60 who call themselves Boy, stuffy dowagers known as Baby, and one of Cory's cabinet ministers has the given name Joker. Commander Melody was in his 40s. He was barefoot and dressed in camouflage pants, a sky blue t-shirt with the logo of the Benedictine Sisters on it, a jean jacket, and a red, white, and blue cotton beach hat. His men were only a little younger, and clothed more like teenage New York bicycle messengers than Viet Cong. Part of a large, faded tattoo was visible on Commander Melody's ankle, the kind of tattoo worn by Philippine street gangs. The commander had the skinny, somber intensity of an ex-fuck-up. "How do you feel about Cory Aquino?" I asked. "Is she better than Marcos?"
"Yes, Marcos a dictator man," said Commander Melody. "Not democracy, if our own new constitution..."
He trailed off, wrestling with the English. Commander Melody thought for a moment, then made a pronouncement.
"We will now surrender over our guns if we can find a good government that we can keep."
This was strange. The NPA national leadership had just announced a new offensive to carry revolutionary violence into Manila proper. "Do you feel you can surrender to Cory?" I said.
"Yes."
"How about General Ramos? Do you trust Ramos?"
"Yes."
"You can surrender to him?"
"Yes."
I was mixed up. "Well, why don't you just, you know, surrender?" Commander Melody told me a story which, I think, was supposed to explain that. He said he'd been an ordinary citizen, driver of a Manila jeepney bus, a jeep with a long covered bed and two beach seats in back. He'd had an accident and killed three policemen. This seemed pretty careless, even considering the way people drive in Manila. Anyway, he'd been sentenced to 10 years in prison and had escaped and headed for the hills. Commander Melody said the NPA was hungry, poor, almost out of bullets, and tired, too.
"Our guys always climbing mountain, then to barrio and port city."
He and his men all shrugged like the whole thing was getting to be a pain in the neck. "Do you consider yourself communists?" I asked. The old 50,000 casualty question, ground war in Asia category. This is the only thing Americans ever really want to know. It's how we decide whether to send in Oliver Stone and his platoon of pals to atrocity everybody.
"We are not looking for that," said Commander Melody with some heat. "We don't need a communist country.
We know communist countries are dictatorship countries. We are only fighting for our rights.
But the ideology of the NPA, I mumbled vaguely. One thing they don't teach you at the close cover before striking school of journalism is how to badger people who've got guns.
There are big differences upon our procedures,
mumbled Commander Melody, pretty vaguely himself. I guess he was referring to NPA internal snits and quarrels. I nodded sympathetically. What would it take you to get you to make peace with the Cory government?
If you are not rich, you can't do your own business, he said. Better if Cory makes a lot of factories for poor people to work in.
Much better, I would think, but Commander Melody didn't seem to have any specific suggestions about how that was to be done. How could the United States help? I asked. Commander Melody's eyes lit up, and his mouth dropped open.
They would help our organization?
He looked like a kid who'd been told that next year would have Christmas on every weekend. It broke my heart to disabuse him. No, I said. I'm afraid not. They think you're communists. Commander Melody nodded. He'd known all along it was too good to be true.
We have no justice, he said. So our justices are guns and bullets.
He told me they had just completed a mission. Jeepney-riding communist rebels, the newspaper had said, and jeepney-driving had been Commander Melody's profession before he took up politics. And he said they delayed another mission just to talk to me. I took this as a hint for a donation. Now, nobody hates a commie worse than me, and Commander Melody's line of hooey aside, the New People's Army is communist. When they were negotiating with Cory, their demands were straight out of the Mickey Maoist Club bylaws. They are red as a baboon's ass, and that means freeze and assume the position as far as I'm concerned. I've been to your communist countries. They are crap-your-pants, ugly, dull as church, dead from the dick-up places where government is to life, what pantyhose are to sex. But then I looked at Commander Melody in his Gilligan's Island hat. He and his ragamuffin bunch were sitting there with the entire population of the barrio acting as their lookouts. They were underarmed and underfed, but, you know, I think they were having a good time, too. I'd rather be running around the country at night with a gun than sitting in jail. I could understand why they weren't too eager to surrender. What the fuck? I gave them 1,000 pesos. Commander Melody held up an Armalite bullet in one hand and my sheaf of peso notes in the other.
"This will buy some answers," he said.
If they were going to shoot mayors, they couldn't be all bad. Maybe they'd take a shot at Ed Koch. It was hard to figure what kind of story I could write about Commander Melody's goofy NPA, but it was a flagrantly beautiful afternoon, much too pretty to spend the whole day indoors playing with guns. I'd worry about what to write later. Bahala na, as the Filipinos say, which is an untranslatable phrase containing the same germ of philosophy as the Arabic inshallah, or the Spanish mañana, or the English you must have me mixed up with somebody who gives a shit. Franco and I decided to fuck off and take a drive in the country. It was Sunday, cockfight day. We stopped in the town of Santa Ana, about half an hour south of Marlita. It seemed like the people there hadn't seen an American in ages. They all waved and shouted, "Hi, Joe! Hi, Joe!" just like they'd shouted to my dad 40 years ago. Cockfighting has always been my idea of a great sport. Two armed entrees battling to see who'll be dinner. The Santa Ana cockpit was an open-sided structure with grandstands, the most elaborate building in town, except the church. The pit itself was raised, dirt-floored, and about twice the size of a boxing ring, and enclosed with blood-smeared glass panels. The roosters are allowed to peck each other's behinds to get them in a bad mood. Then the owners carry them around for everyone to see. The bookies are right in the ring with the poultry, and following the wake of the McNuggets display, taking bets. If you bet big, you get to sit down in the front and press your nose against the glass. Would Joe bet? A subject of great interest and levity in the audience. The birds are bred not only to be crabby, but to have insane plumage. I won 100 pesos on a chicken that looked exactly like David Lee Roth. I don't know why the ASPCA gets its boxer shorts in a wad every time our Hispanic cousins have a cockfight in the Bronx.
This is a lot less violent than the Super Bowl, and who wants an extra crispy quarterback anyway? Each cock gets one razor steel spur about half the length of a ballpoint pen. This is tied on the back of his claw just below the drumstick. The fights are one or two sneezes long, and, as a visual spectacle, resemble